sweet landscape, along with clean water, tillable land, and black soil. To call land sweet was a way of saying it answered our desires. The fact that the apple was generally believed to be the fateful tree in the Garden of Eden might also have commended it to a religious people who believed America promised a second Eden. In fact, the Bible never names the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, and that part of the world is generally too hot for apples, but at least since the Middle Ages, northern Europeans have assumed that the forbidden fruit was an apple. Some scholars think it was a pomegranate. This mistake strikes me as yet another example of the apple's gift for insinuating itself into every sort of human environment, even, apparently, a biblical one. Like a botanical zealot, the apple has wormed its way into our image of Eden through the brushwork of Dürer and Cranach and countless others. After their pictures, recreating a promised land anywhere in the New World without an apple tree would have been unthinkable, especially to a Protestant. There was an old tradition in northern Europe linking the grape, which flourished all through Latin Christendom, with the corruptions of the Catholic Church, while casting the apple as the wholesome fruit of Protestantism. Wine figured in the Eucharist. Also, the Old Testament warned against the temptations of the grape. But the Bible didn't have a bad word to say about the apple or even the strong drink that could be made from it. Even the most God-fearing Puritan could persuade himself that cider had been given a theological free pass. The desire of the Puritan, distant from help and struggling for bare existence, to add the pippin to his slender list of comforts and the sour cider to cheer his heart and liver, must be considered a fortunate circumstance, a speaker told a meeting of the Massachusetts Horticultural Society in 1885. Perhaps he inclined to cider because it was nowhere spoken against in the scriptures. Whether this was really the reason or a rationale concocted after the fact, Americans were indeed strongly inclined to cider, an inclination that accounts for the high esteem in which the apple was held in the colonies and on the frontier. In fact, there was hardly anything else to drink. Alcohol is, of course, the other great beneficence of sugar. It is made by encouraging certain yeasts to dine on the sugars manufactured in plants. Fermentation converts the glucose in plants into ethyl alcohol and carbon dioxide. The sweetest fruit makes the strongest drink, and in the North, where grapes didn't do well, that was usually the apple. Up until Prohibition, an apple grown in America was far less likely to be eaten than to wind up in a barrel of cider. Hard cider is a 20th century term, redundant before then since virtually all cider was hard until modern refrigeration allowed people to keep sweet cider sweet. Corn liquor, or white lightning, preceded cider on the frontier by a few years, but after the apple trees began to bear fruit, cider, being safer, tastier, and much easier to make, became the alcoholic drink of choice. Just about the only reason to plant an orchard of the sort of seedling apples John Chapman had for sale would have been its intoxicating harvest of drink, available to anyone with a press and a barrel. Allowed to ferment for a few weeks, pressed apple juice yields a mildly alcoholic beverage with about half the strength of wine. For something stronger, the cider can then be distilled into brandy or simply frozen. The intensely alcoholic liquid that refuses to ice is called applejack. Hard cider frozen to 30 degrees below zero yields an applejack of 66 proof. Virtually every homestead in America had an orchard from which literally thousands of gallons of cider were made every year. In rural areas, cider took the place not only of wine and beer, but of coffee and tea, juice, and even water. Indeed, in many places, cider was consumed more freely than water, even by children, since it was arguably the healthier, because more sanitary, beverage. Cider became so indispensable to rural life that even those who railed against the evil of alcohol made an exception for cider, and the early prohibitionists succeeded mainly in switching drinkers over from grain to apple spirits. Eventually, they would attack cider directly and launch their campaign to chop down apple trees, but up until the end of the 19th century, cider continued to enjoy the theological exemption the Puritans had contrived for it. It wasn't until this century that the apple acquired its reputation for wholesomeness. "An apple a day keeps the doctor away" was a marketing slogan dreamed up by growers concerned that temperance would cut into sales. In 1900, the horticulturist Liberty Hyde Bailey wrote that the eating of the apple, rather than the drinking of it, has come to be paramount. But for the two centuries before that, whenever an American extolled the virtues of the apple, whether it was John Winthrop or Thomas Jefferson, Henry Ward Beecher or John Chapman, their contemporaries would probably have smiled knowingly, hearing in their words a distinct Dionysian echo that we are apt to miss. When Emerson, for instance, wrote that man would be more solitary, less friended, less supported, if the land yielded only the useful maize and potato and withheld this ornamental and social fruit, his readers understood it was the support and sociability of alcohol he had in mind. Americans' inclination toward cider is the only way to explain John Chapman's success. How the man could have made a living selling spitters to Ohio settlers when there were already grafted trees bearing edible fruit for sale in Marietta. Mount Vernon, Ohio, is a classic early 19th century town, a modest grid of streets laid out around a central square of green, a short walk from the meeting place of two streams. In the library on the square is a map of the town made in 1805, the year it was platted. If you look down in the bottom left-hand corner, where Owl Creek curves in to disturb the tidy grid, you can see lots 145 and 147, both of which were bought by John Chapman in 1809 for the sum of $50. Follow the creek to the far right-hand edge of the map and you'll see a neat rank of apple trees, representing what is thought to be one of Chapman's nurseries. I'd come to Mount Vernon, following the Muskingum and its tributaries north from Marietta, to meet Ohio's leading authority on Johnny Appleseed. William Ellery Jones is a 51-year-old fundraising consultant and amateur historian with a dream: to establish a Johnny Appleseed Heritage Center and outdoor theater on a hillside outside Mansfield. When I had phoned him the month before at his home in Cincinnati, he generously offered to give me a guided tour of Johnny Appleseed country. Jones hinted that he had made some important discoveries, the locations of various Chapman sites and relics, and he indicated that, if I played my cards right, I might get to see a few of them. This seemed a little too good to be true. Finding a Virgil in Appleseed country with one phone call? 3 days spent driving around Ohio in the company of this gentle monomaniac confirmed that assessment. The Heritage Center and outdoor theater should have been my tip-off. Within moments of our handshake, I could see that Bill Jones was deeply invested in precisely the version of Chapman's life I'd come west to escape: St. Appleseed. "Chapman is a hero for our time," he told me in dead earnest when I asked what had attracted him to Chapman's story. "His philanthropy, his selflessness, his Christian faith. John Chapman was also America's first environmentalist. I ask you, could you invent a better role model for our children?" I decided to wait a bit before bringing up the child bride or the Applejack. Jones is a tall, courtly man with pale blue eyes and fine, parchment-like skin. He gives the impression of being a tightly stretched drum of a man, devoid of irony and, by his own rights, somewhat out of place in time. He's dismayed by present-day America, the popular culture, the violence, the lack of moral compass. Ohio's frontier past is vividly present to him, and old-timey expressions like cripes, gee willikers, and darn tootin' come often and unselfconsciously to his lips. One of the first things I noticed about Bill were his delicate white hands and the multiple pairs of leather gloves he carried in his briefcase. Though it was only October, Bill would don the gloves while pumping gas or even indoors, when handed a hot mug of coffee. After we got to know each other a bit, he mentioned that he was certain Chapman had been an obsessive compulsive, and that people used to make fun of Chapman's delicate hands. "If you didn't have fingers like thumbs back then, folks were liable to say you were effeminate." Jones had put together an ambitious itinerary between Mount Vernon and Fort Wayne, beginning with a brisk morning walk to plots 145 and 147. Chapman's two landholdings in Mount Vernon stand across the street from each other, on the banks of Owl Creek. Jones said he was applying to the state to have historical markers erected on the site, now the parking lot of a tire dealership. Owl Creek looked far too shallow and sluggish to serve as the busy thoroughfare Jones described, but he pointed out that reservoirs and dams had long ago tamed most of the local streams and rivers. Chapman's Mount Vernon property was, I would discover, typical of his holdings. The land hugged a stream, ensuring water for his seedlings early on and sales traffic later, and they were located on the edge of a new settlement. That particular tropism, pulling Chapman from the center of things out to the margins, proved to be a constant with the man and his life's project. Over the next few days, Bill showed me all over Appleseed Country and did an impressive job of bringing that quasi-historical place to life. We traipsed through a dozen of Chapman's former nurseries, pulled over at the drop of a historical marker. Jones deplored the recent switch from brass to aluminum, and stood on a handful of undistinguished street corners that Bill alone knew were crucial Appleseed sites. On the banks of the Auglaize River, we found the site of the famous sycamore stump Chapman had once lived in, now the front lawn of a ranch house. And in a run-down section of Mansfield, we visited the site of his kid sister Persis Broom's house, now a drive-through liquor store called the Galloping Goose. In defiance, we climbed to the top of a water treatment plant to obtain an unobstructed view of one Appleseed nursery. And near Loudonville, we paddled a canoe for 2 hours to catch a glimpse of another. On a farm outside Savannah, we took pictures of each other standing next to an ancient, half-dead apple tree that may or may not have been planted by Chapman. All the while, Jones spooned tales of Johnny Appleseed, a rich soup of legend sprinkled with chunks of historical and biographical fact. Most of what's known about Chapman comes from accounts left by the many settlers who welcomed him into their cabins, offering the famous apple man, Evangelist, a meal and a place to sleep. In exchange, his hosts were happy to have Chapman's news, of Indians and heaven, of his own fantastic exploits, and apple trees. He'd usually plant a couple as a token of his thanks. There was, too, the sheer entertainment value of a guest who was, literally, a legend in his own time. Chapman lived everywhere and nowhere. He was constantly on the move, traveling in autumn to Allegheny County to gather seeds, scouting nursery sites and planting in the spring, repairing fences at old nurseries in summer, and, wherever he planted, signing up local agents to keep an eye on and sell his trees, since he was seldom in one place long enough to do that work himself. Even into his 60s, after moving his base of operations to Indiana, Chapman made an annual pilgrimage to central Ohio to look after his nurseries there. His absentee management meant he was frequently gypped, and his land claims were often jumped, though whenever this happened, Chapman's main concern seems to have been for the welfare of his trees. In spite of these setbacks, he managed to accumulate enough cash to build up his real estate holdings and give money away to people in need, frequently strangers. As Bill pointed out, the size of his estate, which included some 22 parcels of land, is hard to square with the notion that he was feeble-minded or feckless. Even so, he was undoubtedly one of the oddest characters in our history, as a 19th-century historian in Mount Vernon put it. From the reminiscences of the settlers he visited along the route of his annual migration have sprung tall tales of his endurance, generosity, gentleness, heroism, and, it must be said, his unreconstructed strangeness. Jones knows all these tales by heart, and though he is agnostic on the veracity of the tallest ones, he was happy to pass them on. Most of them, anyway. Not surprisingly, Bill dwelled on stories of Chapman's heroism, and together we retraced a portion of the famous Barefoot Run of 1812. During the war with England, Indians allied with the British occasionally rampaged, and late one September night, Chapman sprinted 30 miles through the forest from Mansfield to Mount Vernon to warn the settlers of their approach. "Behold, the tribes of the heathens are round about your doors," he's supposed to have cried, "and a devouring flame followeth after them." As the high-flown diction suggests, Chapman figured himself the hero of a latter-day biblical narrative, a man anointed to blow the trumpet in the wilderness. This he would blow in every cabin he visited, asking his hosts after supper if they would hear some news right fresh from heaven, before producing the Swedenborgian tracts he kept tucked into his waistband. Black eyes blazing, he'd then launch into a sermon fired with a mystic's zeal. Chapman saw himself as a bumblebee on the frontier, bringer of both the seeds and the word of God. Of both sweetness, that is, and light. Swedenborgian doctrine, which holds that everything here on earth corresponds directly to something in the afterlife, might explain the strange and wonderful ways Chapman conducted himself in nature. The same landscape his countrymen treated as hostile, heathen, and therefore theirs to conquer, Chapman regarded as beneficent in every particular. In his eyes, even the lowliest worm glowed with divine purpose. His kindness to animals was notorious, an outrage to frontier custom. It was said he'd sooner douse his campfire than singe the mosquitoes attracted to its flame. Chapman often used his profits to purchase lame horses to save them from slaughter, and once he freed a wolf he found snared in a trap, nursing the animal to health and then keeping it as a pet. When he discovered one evening that the hollowed-out log in which he intended to spend the night was already occupied by bear cubs, he let them be, making his bed in the snow instead. Chapman could sleep anywhere, it seems, though he was partial to hollowed-out logs or a hammock slung between two trees. One time, he floated 100 miles down the Allegheny on a block of ice, sleeping the whole way. Curiously, a great many stories about Chapman have to do with his feet. How he'd go barefoot in any weather, the time he punished his foot for stepping on a worm, or in some versions, a snake. He would entertain boys by pressing needles or hot coals into the soles of his feet, which had grown as horny and tough as an elephant's. Ripe for ridicule, though he must have been, boys were so awed by his fortitude that they never made fun of him. Listening to an itinerant preacher in Mansfield pound his tree stump pulpit and ask, one too many times, "Where now is there a man who, like the primitive Christians, is traveling to heaven barefoot and clad in coarse raiments?" Chapman roused himself from the log he was reclining against and planted his bare, ugly foot square in the middle of the preacher's stump. "Here's your primitive Christian." The recurring barefoot theme underscores the sense people had that Chapman's relationship to nature was special, and not quite human. The soles of our shoes interpose a protective barrier between us and the earth that Chapman had no use for. If shoes are part and parcel of a civilized life, Chapman had one foot planted in another realm, had at least that much in common with the animals. Whenever I hear or read about Chapman's horny bare feet, I can't help picturing him as some kind of satyr or centaur. But in spite of his peculiar attire and personal habits, those who knew him said he was never repulsive. People were happy to have him as a guest in their homes, and parents would let him bounce their babies on his lap. Shadowy stories about Chapman's love life seemed to have followed him across the frontier, but whenever I asked Bill Jones about this, he tightened up. In one account, Chapman had come west after a girl had stood him up at the altar back in Massachusetts. To people who asked him why he had never married, he would say that God had promised him a true wife in heaven if he would abstain from marriage on earth. In the most curious of these stories, recounted by Price, Chapman made an arrangement with a frontier family to raise their 10-year-old daughter to be his bride. For several years, Chapman paid regular visits to the girl and contributed to her upkeep, until one visit when he chanced to witness his young fiancée flirting with some boys her own age. Wounded and enraged, Chapman abruptly broke off the relationship. True or not, the stories hint at a sexual eccentricity of some kind. Or maybe his libido was submerged in some sort of polymorphous love of nature, as some biographers have theorized about Thoreau. Gingerly, I tried at one point to raise the subject with Bill. My timing was perhaps not the best. We were in my rental car, driving up the wooded hillside near Mansfield where he hoped someday to build his Heritage Center and Class A outdoor theater, a destination for school groups and families on vacation, as he'd told me more than once. And here I was, asking whether he thought his hero might have had a thing for young girls. "I know exactly what story you're referencing," Jones said tightly. "The child bride. In my opinion, it is completely implausible." Jones was silent for a time and then worked himself into a denunciation of the sort of people who feel compelled to take our heroes down a peg. And then, pulling tensely on the corners of his mouth, he confided his deepest, darkest fear about Chapman, a charge about his hero's sexuality that, though baseless, though never, in fact, even alleged by anyone, nevertheless stood to ruin everything we're trying to do. I'm sorry to say that the price of hearing this rumor was a promise not to tell. Jones had his own G-rated theory of Chapman's love life, something having to do with a Massachusetts girl who may have broken a promise to join him in Ohio. "That's as much as I can tell you right now," Bill said. He sounded as if he were talking to Bob Woodward in a parking garage. I pressed, gently. "Nope, not a word until I can get this all nailed down and published." That night, I went to hear Bill give a talk about Chapman at the Loudonville Historical Society, a stop on his one-man campaign to build support for his Heritage Center and outdoor theater. 50 or so, mostly retired folks in folding chairs, sipped coffee and listened politely as Jones pressed his case. John Chapman is just the exemplary figure to help our children navigate a treacherous world, yet no one is telling his story. As he spoke, the slide projector showed an early engraving of Chapman made by a woman who had known him in Ohio. Scraggly and barefoot, he's wearing a sackcloth cinched at the waist like a dress and a tin pot on his head. In one hand, he's holding out an apple sapling like a scepter. The man looks completely insane. Bill's talk took the rhetorical form of a sermon, with the line, "No one is telling his story," serving as its thumping refrain. He was determined to cut Chapman's life to a Christian pattern, and the stories he told were the ones that made the case for beatification. Proto-environmentalist, philanthropist, friend to children and animals and Indians. It was pap, little more, and I wasn't the only person in the room to grow impatient, especially when Jones got around to the apples, which he praised incredibly as an important source of vitamin C on the frontier. Just then, an old guy behind me poked an elbow in his neighbor's ribs and whispered, "So does he ever get around to the Applejack?" He did not. Bill was doing Lives of the Frontier Saints, and there was no place in it for alcohol, or mysticism, or romance, or psychological weirdness of any kind. The sole mention of cider was cider vinegar, vital as a preservative. So that's who John Chapman was. Patron saint of pickling. Afterward, as we were packing up Bill's tripods and slides, I asked him about the omission. He smiled. "Come on, this is a family show." I believe I got a better glimpse of John Chapman the following morning when Bill and I set out to canoe a stretch of the Mohican north of Loudonville. Bill wanted to show me a riverside nursery of Chapman's, and I was curious to see the country from a perspective nearer to Chapman's own. From the water, I mean, since it was by canoe or pirogue that he usually traveled. On the old maps Chapman carried, the rivers and streams appear as strong black lines against a whole lot of blank space. His America ordered itself around those veiny lines the way ours does around highways. On them, you could travel from the spot where Bill and I were starting out all the way to Pittsburgh or to the Mississippi, depending on which way you turned at Marietta. The sun was not yet up over the trees when we put into the river a few miles above Perrysville. Me taking the seat up front since Bill was the more experienced canoer. The water, moving with surprising dispatch for the time of year, looked like a freshly black-topped road, except where snags flustered its surface, causing it to sparkle. In places, spooky mists rose from the surface, and the banks were so thickly lined with trees, giant cottonwoods leaning way out over the water, spectacularly contorted sycamores, that it wasn't hard to pretend we were pushing through a wilderness. In fact, acres of newly cut corn lay just beyond the line of trees, and at one point I glimpsed a chugging factory through an opening in the leaves. We slipped by mergansers and mallards and saw a pileated woodpecker pile-driving the trunk of a dead tree on the bank. At one point, a young wood duck allowed us to follow it for at least 100 feet, probably trying to lead us away from a nest. Judging the coast clear, the bird exploded noisily into flight. After we'd been paddling along for an hour or so, Bill pointed to a broad table of open land off to our left. This was the site of Greentown, a sprawling Indian village Chapman often visited, at least before it was torched by settlers during the War of 1812. Just a few 100 yards farther on, at the spot where a tiny creek dribbled into the river, was the site of Chapman's apple tree nursery. I lifted my paddle, and through the trees I could see a rough stubble of corn on a gently curving skin of black earth. The nursery's proximity to an Indian town might have troubled another man, but Chapman moved easily between the societies of settler and Native American, even when the two were at war. The Indians regarded Chapman as a brilliant woodsman and medicine man. In addition to the apples, which the Indians were eager for, Chapman brought with him the seeds of a dozen different medicinal plants, including mullein, motherwort, dandelion, wintergreen, pennyroyal, and mayweed, and he was expert in their use. Chapman's ability to freely cross borders that other people believed to be fixed and unbreachable, between the red world and the white, between wilderness and civilization, even between this world and the next, was one of the hallmarks of his character and probably the thing that most confounded people about the man, both then and now. It certainly confounded me. From a conventional distance, at least, Chapman's whole life appears to have been a skein of warring terms and contradictions no ordinary mind could hope to sustain, much less resolve. As Bill and I glided slowly down the Mohican, each of us alone with his thoughts, I tried to list some of these contradictions, hoping to discover some pattern. Chapman combined the flinty toughness of a Daniel Boone with the gentleness of a Hindu. He was a deeply pious man, sometimes insufferably so, I imagine. Will you have some news right fresh from heaven? Yet people said he could also enjoy a drink, a pinch of snuff, too, and tell a good joke, often at his own expense. I wondered how he squared the two vocations that occupied his days. That is, bringing to people leading stringent frontier lives two very different kinds of consolation, God's word and hard drink. The paradoxes piled up. An agent of civilization, working to domesticate the wilderness with his apple trees and herbs and religion, he was at the same time completely at home in the undomesticated wild, as well as in the company of Native Americans, to whom that civilization was toxic. A barefoot backwoodsman draped in sackcloth, Chapman could hold forth knowledgeably on Swedenborgian theology, perhaps the most intellectually demanding religious doctrine of the time. Maybe that was the key. Maybe it was Swedenborg's thought that gave Chapman's mind just what it needed to dissolve all these paradoxes. In Swedenborg's philosophy, there is no rift between the natural world and the divine. Much like Emerson, who cited him as an influence, Swedenborg claimed that there were one-to-one correspondences between natural and spiritual facts, so that close attention and devotion to the former would advance one's understanding of the latter. Thus, an apple tree in bloom was part of the natural process of making fruit. At the same time, it was a living sermon from God. Likewise, a crow wheeling overhead was a type of the black forces waiting to overtake men's souls when they wandered off the path. The river before you might be that path, yet a wrong turn on it might land you in Newark, Ohio, a hard-drinking town notorious for gambling and prostitution that Chapman believed offered a literal preview of hell. Everything before us was doubled. Not this world or that, but both. Fervently held, such beliefs must have lit up the whole landscape. The rivers and trees, the bears and wolves and crows, even the mosquitoes, with a divine glow. Every path through the woods was capitalized, every deprivation a spiritual test. Minus the Christian symbolism, I imagine Chapman's was a world much like that inhabited by the ancient Greeks, in which all nature and experience were suffused with divine significance. The storms, the dawns, the strangers at your door. One looked outward to the land for meaning, rather than inward or upward. This was not how nature ordinarily appeared to Americans in Chapman's time. To most of them, the forest was still a heathen chaos. Remember that by the time the New England Transcendentalists began to find the divine in nature, God's second book, they called it, their landscape had been securely under human control for more than a century. Walden Woods was far from a wilderness. For Chapman, the natural world, even at its wildest, was never a falling away or a distraction from the spirit world. It was continuous with it. In some ways, this doctrine chimes with the Native Americans' cosmology, which could account for the kinship Chapman felt for Indians and they for him. Chapman's mystical teachings veer about as close to pantheism and nature worship as Christianity has ventured. In Puritan New England, he'd have been jailed as a heretic. It may have been Chapman's conviction that this world is a type or a rough draft of the next that allowed him to overlook or dissolve the tensions the rest of us perceive between the realms of matter and spirit, as well as nature and civilization. For him, these borders may simply not have been real. So many of the legends about Appleseed depict him as a kind of liminal figure, part man and part, well, something else. The something else, which was perhaps symbolized by the soles of his bare feet calloused to a tough hide, is what permitted him to live with one of those feet planted in our world, the other in the wild. He was a kind of satyr without the sex. A Protestant satyr, you might say, moving through these woods as if they were his true home, making his bed in hollowed logs and his breakfast from a butternut tree, keeping the company of wolves. As I thought about the scattering of settlers along these streams who would welcome Chapman into their homes, offering a meal and a bed to this strange man in rags, I was reminded of how the gods of classical mythology would sometimes appear at people's doors, dressed as beggars. Just to be on the safe side, the Greeks would shower hospitality on even the most dubious stranger, because you never knew when the ragged fellow on your doorstep might turn out to be Athena in disguise. It's true that Johnny Appleseed's fame usually preceded him, but you couldn't blame a settler family for wondering if the man who'd appeared at their door didn't have something otherworldly about him. There was the gleam in his eyes that everyone remarked on, and the news he brought of other worlds, the wild, the Indian, the heavenly, and, of course, there was the precious gift of those apples. As we glided through the woods to the music of birds and the splish swirl of our paddles stitching the black water, I tried to summon an image of Chapman. I fell back on one of the slides Bill had shown the night before at the Historical Society. This one was an etching that had accompanied an 1871 article about Chapman in Harper's New Monthly Magazine, and it depicted Chapman as a sinewy, barefoot figure with a goatish beard, wearing, again, something that looks very much like a toga or a dress. The effect was of a creature part man and part woman. Yet it was even more ambiguous than that, since the slight figure with the goat's beard also seems to be melting into or out of, the shadowy trees all around. What a strange image, I remember thinking, and now I thought I understood why. Chapman appeared in it as a faintly Christianized version of some pagan wood god, and that seemed just about right. By the time I entertained this little epiphany, the sun had risen high enough behind the trees to flare wildly between the cottonwood leaves, almost like a strobe, momentarily turning the riverscape into a silhouette of itself. I saw Chapman now as clearly as I could hope to. Johnny Appleseed was no Christian saint. That left out too much of who he was, what he stood for in our mythology. Who he was, I realized, was the American Dionysus. After the river trip, my interest in Bill Jones's John Chapman began to flicker, which was too bad for me because we still had a lot of ground to cover between here and Fort Wayne, where I planned to catch a flight home. I found myself tuning out a touching story about Chapman buying a new set of china for a family who'd lost all their possessions in a fire. It felt as though there were now two John Chapmans riding with us in the car, Bill's Christian saint and my pagan god, and the front seat began to feel too small for the both of them. This made for an extremely long ride to Fort Wayne. When at last I got home, I went looking for Appleseed again, this time in the library. I read everything I could find about Dionysus, about whom I knew only the usual high school basics. Teaching men how to ferment the juice of the grape, Dionysus had brought civilization the gift of wine. This was more or less the same gift Johnny Appleseed was bringing to the frontier. Because American grapes weren't sweet enough to be fermented successfully, the apple served as the American grape, cider the American wine. But as I delved deeper into the myth of Dionysus, I realized there was much more to his story. And the strangely changeable god who began to come into focus bore a remarkable resemblance to John Chapman. Or at least to Johnny Appleseed, who, I became convinced, is Dionysus's American son. Like Johnny Appleseed, Dionysus was a figure of the fluid margins, slipping back and forth between the realms of wildness and civilization, man and woman, man and god, beast and man. I found Dionysus depicted variously as a wild man with foliage sprouting from his head, a goat, a bull, a tree, and a woman. Friedrich Nietzsche paints Dionysus as a figure able to dissolve all the rigid and hostile barriers between nature and culture. The Greeks regarded Dionysus as the antithesis of Apollo, god of clear boundaries, order, and light. Of man's firm control over nature. Dionysian revelry melts every Apollonian line, so that, as Nietzsche writes, alienated, hostile, or subjugated nature celebrates her reconciliation with her lost son, man. By worshipping Dionysus and getting drunk on his wine, the Athenians temporarily return to nature, to a time when, as the classicist Jane Harrison writes, man is still, to his own thinking, brother of plants and animals. The odd, ecstatic worship of Dionysus, which needed no temple, always took place outside the city, returning religion to the woods where it had begun. I learned also that Dionysus was the god originally responsible for the marriage of people and plants that John Chapman's double-hulled canoe had symbolized for me. In The Golden Bough, James Fraser says that, in addition to the grapevine, Dionysus was also the patron of cultivated trees and specifically credits him with the discovery of the apple. He was, in fact, the god of domestication itself, bringing wisdom from the very breast of nature, Nietzsche, teaching men not only to ferment wine but also to hitch their plow to the ox. Dionysus brought wild plants into the house of civilization, but, by the same token, his own untamed presence reminded people of the untamed nature on which that house always rests, somewhat unsteadily. The same, I realized, was true of Johnny Appleseed. Nothing better captures the paradox of Dionysus's double role as a force for domestication and wildness than his involvement with grapes and wine. Wine itself is a peculiarly liminal substance, poised on the edge of nature and culture as well as civility and abandon. It is truly an extraordinary thing, this artful transformation of raw nature, a fruit, into a substance with the power to alter human perception. Yet wine is an achievement of civilization we're apt to take for granted or condemn, perhaps especially as Americans, for whom alcohol has always presented a moral problem. The Greeks, who were much better at holding contradictory ideas in their minds than we are, understood that intoxication could be divine or wretched, a ceremony of human communion or madness, depending on the care taken in handling its magic. Wine is rudderless, Plato warned. He advised mixing it with water and serving it in tiny cups. Dionysian revelry, which begins in ecstasy and often ends in blood, embodies this truth. The same wine that loosens the knots of inhibition and reveals nature's most beneficent face can also dissolve the bonds of civilization and unleash ungovernable passions. This is why, of all the gods, Dionysus is, for humans, fiercest and most sweet, according to Euripides. If Apollo is a god of concentrated light, Dionysus, worshipped at night, is a god of dispersed sweetness. Under his influence, the earth flows beneath us, then milk flows, and wine flows, and nectar flows like flame. Under the spell of Dionysus and his wine, all nature answers to our desires. As for the fierce part of the Dionysian drama, this Johnny Appleseed did not play. He was a far more gentle, less sexual being than Dionysus, though his gender does sometimes seem equally amorphous. Come to think of it, Chapman did sponsor sex orgies, but only among apple trees. The flight from civilization back to nature in America tends to be a solitary and ascetic pursuit, having more to do with wilderness than wildness. Johnny Appleseed was very much an American Dionysus. Innocent and mild. In this, he may have helped establish the benign, see-no-evil mood that characterizes the Dionysian strain in American culture, from transcendentalist Concord to the Summer of Love. We can hear him now, a woman who had known Chapman reminisced in the 1871 Harper's article. Just as we did that summer day when we were busy quilting upstairs and he lay near the door, his voice rising denunciatory and thrilling, strong and loud as the roar of wind and waves, then soft and soothing as the balmy airs that quivered the morning glory leaves about his gray beard. His was a strange eloquence at times, and he was undoubtedly a man of genius. Imagine how riveting such a figure must have appeared on the American frontier, this gentle wild man who arrived at your door as if straight from the bosom of nature, wreathed in morning glory leaves, no less. He came bearing ecstatic news from other worlds and, with his apple trees and cider, promising a measure of sweetness in this one. To a pioneer laboring under the brute facts of frontier life, confronting daily the indifferent face of nature, Johnny Appleseed's words and seeds offered release from the long sentence of ordinariness, held out a hope of transcendence. Under the spell of this otherworldly figure, the world outside one's cabin window suddenly appeared very different, no longer quite so literal or firmly lashed to the here and now. Eyes blazing, Johnny Appleseed would show you how to see the divine in nature, his strange eloquence transforming the everyday landscape into a vivid theater of appearances. You could tell yourself this was good Christian doctrine, but truly it was mystical and ecstatic, dwelling more on the all-around sweetness of nature than the singular light of Christ above. And if his words didn't by themselves make the earth flow and the milk and wine and nectar flow like flame, There were then the apple trees he planted, sacramental in their own way, and perhaps most potent of all, the cider those trees would produce. For one of the wonders of alcohol is that it suffuses the world around us, this cold, indifferent planet, with the warm glow of meaning, or at least spins that illusion. This was the gift of sweetness he brought into the country. Though Johnny Appleseed may have lacked Dionysus's complimentary fierceness, he did deliver in his person a thrilling, scary reminder of the nearness of savagery and the tenuousness of civilization's grip. In both his person and his stories, he temporarily dissolved the stark opposition of wilderness and civilization that organized frontier life. I imagine that pioneers struggling to get by in the wilderness regarded Appleseed as a welcome contrast gainer. However straitened your frontier existence might be, you couldn't gaze on John Chapman without counting your blessings. At least you had leather shoes and a warm hearth, a sociable table and a roof over your head. Your guests' tales of subsisting one winter on butternuts alone, or sharing a bed of leaves with a wolf, would have warmed the draftiest cabin, deepened the savor of the most meager meal. Sometimes the cause of civilization is best served by a hard stare into the soul of its opposite. Some such principle may have underwritten Dionysian revelry in ancient Athens. And the impulse to invite someone like John Chapman into one's home in 19th century Ohio. Like Dionysus, John Chapman was an agent of domestication. With every cider orchard he helped plant, the wilderness became that much more hospitable and homelike. It just happened to be a home he didn't care to live in himself. But the apple was only one of the many old-world plants John Chapman brought with him into the country. There was the small pharmacopoeia of medicinal herbs, too, and quite a few weeds. I met people in Ohio who still curse Chapman for introducing stinking fennel, a troublesome weed he planted everywhere he went in the belief it could keep a house safe from malaria. Even today, Ohioans call it Johnny Weed. His plantings helped remake the New World landscape in a more familiar image, in the process contributing to an ecological transformation of America, the magnitude of which we've just begun to appreciate. Everyone knows that the settlement of the West depended on the rifle and the axe, yet the seed was no less instrumental in guaranteeing Europeans' success in the New World. The fact that John Chapman is remembered today along with frontier heroes such as Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett suggests that maybe we knew this before we completely understood it. The Europeans brought with them to the frontier a kind of portable ecosystem that allowed them to recreate their accustomed way of life. The grasses their livestock needed to thrive, herbs to keep themselves healthy, old-world fruits and flowers to make life comfortable. This biological settlement of the West often went on beneath the notice of the settlers themselves, who brought along weed seeds in the cracks of their boot soles, grass seeds in the feed bags of their horses, and microbes in their blood and gut. None of these introductions passed beneath the notice of the Native Americans, however. John Chapman, by planting his millions of seeds, simply went about this work more methodically than most. In the process of changing the land, Chapman also changed the apple, or rather made it possible for the apple to change itself. If Americans like Chapman had planted only grafted trees, if Americans had eaten rather than drunk their apples, the apple would not have been able to remake itself and thereby adapt to its new home. It was the seeds and the cider that gave the apple the opportunity to discover by trial and error the precise combination of traits required to prosper in the New World. From Chapman's vast planting of nameless cider apple seeds came some of the great American cultivars of the 19th century. Looked at from this angle, planting seeds instead of clones was an extraordinary act of faith in the American land, A vote in favor of the new and unpredictable as against the familiar and European. In this, Chapman was making the pioneer's classic wager, betting on the fresh possibilities that might grow from seeds planted in the redemptive American ground. This happens to be nature's wager, too, hybridization being one of the ways nature brings newness into the world. John Chapman's millions of seeds and thousands of miles changed the apple, and the apple changed America. No wonder Johnny Appleseed has shaken off the historians and biographers and climbed into our mythology. As far as I know, John Chapman never set foot in Geneva, New York, but there is an orchard there where I caught my last and in some ways most vivid glimpse of him. Here on the banks of Seneca Lake, in excellent apple-growing country, a government outfit called the Plant Genetic Resources Unit maintains the world's largest collection of apple trees. Some 2,500 different varieties have been gathered from all over the world and set out here in pairs, as if on a beached botanical ark. The card catalog of this 50-acre tree archive runs the pomological gamut from Adam's Pearmain, an antique English apple, to the German Zuccomaggio. In between, a browser will find almost every variety discovered in America since the Roxbury Russet distinguished itself in a cider orchard outside Boston in 1645. The Geneva Orchard is, among other things, a museum of the apple's golden age in America, and a few weeks after my trip to the Midwest, I traveled here, alone, to see what of Johnny Appleseed's legacy I might find in its corridors. At first glance, the orchard looks much like any other, the tidy rows of grafted trees advancing like rails to the horizon. But it doesn't take long before you begin to notice the stupendous variety of these trees. In color, leaf, and branching habit, and the metaphor of a library begins to fit. Endless shelves of books that are alike only superficially. When I visited, it was late October, and most of the trees were bent with ripe fruit, though many others had already dropped stunning cloaks of red and yellow and green on the ground around them. I spent the better part of a morning browsing the leafy aisles, tasting all the famous old varieties I'd read about. The Esopus Spitzenberg and Newtown Pippin, the Hawkeye and the Winter Banana. Almost all of these classic varieties were chance seedlings found in exactly the sort of cider orchards John Chapman sponsored. And no doubt there are apples in this orchard that came from the seeds he planted in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana. There's just no way of knowing which ones they are. As I worked my way up and down the aisles, consulting a computerized directory that the collection's curator, Phil Forslein, had printed out for me, I concentrated on the varieties listed as American and thought about exactly what that meant. By planting so many apples from seed, Americans like Chapman had, willy-nilly, conducted a vast evolutionary experiment, allowing the old world apple to try out literally millions of new genetic combinations, and by doing so, to adapt to the new environment in which the tree now found itself. Every time an apple failed to germinate or thrive in American soil, every time an American winter killed a tree or a freeze in May nipped its buds, an evolutionary vote was cast, and the apples that survived this great winnowing became ever so slightly more American. A somewhat different kind of vote was then cast by the discriminating orchardist. Whenever a tree growing in the midst of a planting of nameless cider apples somehow distinguished itself, for the hardiness of its constitution, the redness of its skin, the excellence of its flavor, it would promptly be named, grafted, publicized, and multiplied. Through this simultaneous process of natural and cultural selection, the apples took up into themselves the very substance of America. Its soil and climate and light, as well as the desires and tastes of its people, and even perhaps a few of the genes of America's native crab apples. In time, all these qualities became part and parcel of what an apple in America is. In the years after John Chapman began plying his trade through the Midwest, America witnessed what has sometimes been called the Great Apple Rush. People scoured the countryside for the next champion fruit. The discovery of a Jonathan or Baldwin or Grimes Golden could bring an American fortune and even a measure of fame, and every farmer tended his cider orchard with an eye to the main chance, the apple that would hit it big. Every wild apple shrub excites our expectations thus, Thoreau wrote, somewhat as every wild child. It is, perhaps, a prince in disguise. What a lesson to man! Poets and philosophers and statesmen thus spring up in the country pastures and outlast the hosts of unoriginal men. The nationwide hunt for pomological genius, the odds of which were commonly held to be 80,000 to 1, brought forth literally hundreds of new varieties, including most of the ones I was now tasting. I can report, however, that not all these children of Chapman are outstanding to eat. Many of the apples I sampled that morning were spitters. The Wolf River is particularly memorable in this respect. It had the yellow, wet sawdust flesh of a particularly tired Red Delicious, without even a glint of that apple's beauty. The sheer profusion of qualities that Americans discovered in the apple during its seedling heyday is something to marvel at, especially since so many of those qualities have been lost in the years since. I found apples that tasted like bananas, others like pears. Spicy apples and sticky sweet ones, apples sprightly as lemons and others rich as nuts. I picked apples that weighed more than a pound, others compact enough to fit in a child's pocket. Here were yellow apples, green apples, spotted apples, russet apples, striped apples, purple apples, even a near blue apple. There were apples that looked pre-polished and apples that wore a dusty bloom on their cheeks. Some of these apples had qualities that were completely lost on me, but had meant the world to people once. Apples that tasted sweeter in March than October. Apples that made especially good cider or preserves or butter. Apples that held their own in storage for half a year. Apples that ripen gradually to avoid a surfeit or all at once to simplify the harvest. Apples with long stem or short, thin skin or thick, apples that tasted sublime only in Virginia, and others that needed a hard New England frost to reach perfection. Apples that reddened in August, others that held off till winter, even apples that could sit at the bottom of a barrel for the 6 weeks it took a ship to get to Europe, then emerge bright and crisp enough to command a top price in London. And the names these apples had. Names that reek of the American 19th century, its suspender-popping local boosterism, its shameless Barnum and Bailey hype, its quirky, unfocused grouped individuality. There were the names that set out to describe, often with the help of a well-picked metaphor. The green as a bottle, bottle greening. The sheep nose. The ox heart. The yellow bellflower. The black gilliflower. The 20-ounce pippin. There were the names that puffed with hometown pride, like the Westfield Seek No Further, the Hubbardston Nonesuch, the Rhode Island Greening, the Albemarle Pippin, though the very same Pippin was known as the Newtown nearer to Newtown, New York, the York Imperial, the Kentucky Red Streak, the Long Stem of Pennsylvania, the Lady's Favorite of Tennessee, the King of Tompkins County, the Peach of Kentucky, and the American Nonpareil. There were names that gave credit where credit was due, or so we assume. The Baldwin, the McIntosh, the Jonathan, McAfee's Red, Norton's Melon, Moyer's Prize, Metzger's Calville, Kirk's Golden Rainette, Kelly's White, and Walker's Beauty. And then there were the names that denoted an apple's specialty, like Wismer's Dessert, Jacob's Sweet Winter, the Early Harvest and Cider Apple, the Clothes Yard Apple, the Bread and Cheese, Cornell's Save Well and Putnam's Save Well, Paradise Winter, Payne's Late Keeper, and Hay's Winter Wine. How many other fruits do we call by their Christian names? True, there are a handful of monikered pears and a famous peach or two, But no other fruit in history has produced so many household names, so many celebrities, as the 19th century apples planted by Chapman and his ilk. Like sports franchises or politicians, each had its contingent of supporters, including a few diehards who could direct you to the semi-sacred spot on which that apple had first stood, the site often marked with a monument, and recite its biography, the often astounding story of how its genius was first discovered purely by chance, nearly overlooked, and then given its rightful due. There was the story about the surveyor who